Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for March 30th, Saturday, reading of the Arapaho County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Former Cherry Hills cop living in Aurora faces 6 years in prison after child porn conviction by the Sentinel. Roll with it. Aurora offers free use of all-terrain wheelchairs to explore city trails, by Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Leaders envision future of Arapaho Community College, by Nina Joss. Echo Star to sell Littleton Dish Network office, also by Nina Joss. Colorado schools to receive $11.4 million for youth vaping prevention, by Susie Glassman. Support available in Centennial and Parker for families facing Alzheimer's memory loss, by Haley Lena, and various stories and articles. Former Cherry Hills cop living in Aurora faces 6 years in prison after child porn conviction. A former Cherry Hills Village police officer living in Aurora was convicted by an Arapaho County jury Friday of felony child sexual exploitation. Former Cherry Hills Village Police Detective Jerry Stinnett, 65, was found guilty on two felony counts stemming from a 2020 investigation into videos he was accused of uploading to computer servers and shared, according to officials from the 18th Judicial District Attorney Office. Perpetrators of these kinds of crimes need to know they can't hide behind screens, said Senior Deputy District Attorney Joel Zink, according to a statement released by the District Attorney. Each unthinkable image and video circulated online signifies yet another child subjected to horrific victimization. The investigation began in July 2020 when Stinnett's internet service provider Yahoo reported that a user had uploaded and shared child pornography. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children obtained an IP address from Yahoo and was able to pinpoint the computer's location in Colorado, officials stated. A Colorado Springs Child Crime Task Force won a subpoena for specific information from IP service providers and tracked it to Stinnett's Aurora home. The case was then turned over to Aurora Police, which obtained a search warrant. Multiple computers, tablets, and cell phones were confiscated, the DA office reported. During a search of the devices, detectives found 36 sexually explicit images and videos of underage boys and girls. Investigators said Stinnett worked in law enforcement for 20 years prior to retiring in 2013. In 2010, Cherry Hills Village Police Department said in an annual report that Stinnett was promoted to detective. Stinnett now faces up to 6 years in prison and must register as a sex offender. Sentencing is scheduled for July 5th. Regardless of this defendant's past law enforcement connections, we do not give special treatment to offenders who break the law, District Attorney John Kellner said. He was entrusted by his community for many years as an officer, which makes his actions behind closed doors even more egregious. Roll with it. Aurora offers free use of all-terrain wheelchairs to explore city trails. For wheelchair users in Aurora, being unable to walk means having limited access to many of the prairie and woodland trails that wind around the city. But Aurora's open spaces are more open than ever with the recent rollout of rugged, all-terrain wheelchairs allowing residents with disabilities to explore the trails at the Plains Conservation Center and Star K Ranch. Brian Green of Aurora's Parks, Recreation, and Open Space Department said the city has spent about $36,000 on two action track chairs, featuring tank-like treads that allow users to cruise over the uneven surface of dirt trails. Members of the public can reserve the chairs and use them for free. Since mid-March, visitors to the city's website have been able to block out up to 2 hours to take an action track chair for a spin. Green counted roughly a dozen reservations made for future dates as of March 25th. We have over 80 miles of 100% accessible concrete trails throughout the city. But there are places where we have soft surface trails that are more difficult for just a regular wheelchair, he said. We want people to be able to engage with their family members and others on a hike that's not just on a concrete trail. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 2022, about 5.2% of all Aurora residents had a disability that made walking or climbing stairs difficult. A lack of accessibility options for hiking may make the natural world seem out of reach for these people, particularly wheelchair users and their loved ones. For Aurora residents Melissa and Christopher Chavez, spending time at the beach and going on short hikes with their sons was a regular fixture of the family's life in Florida. After the two welcomed their youngest son, Anthony, and moved to Aurora to be close to Children's Hospital Colorado, the logistics of hiking with a child who couldn't walk on his own limited their ability to get back into nature. At age two, Anthony Chavez was diagnosed with Joubert syndrome, a brain disorder that makes it difficult for patients to use their arms and legs, among other symptoms. The condition means the first grader is unable to walk on his own. He can stand holding on to something, Melissa Chavez said. He's getting stronger and doing amazing, but we're still really limited. Melissa Chavez said her family still finds ways of spending time together outdoors. A few weeks before, the city invited them to test out one of the new wheelchairs. Christopher Chavez carried his son on a short hike to Boulder Falls between Boulder and Nederland. I want my kids to realize Colorado is awesome, Melissa Chavez said. I felt like crying when the city called because Star K Ranch is right in our backyard. Traveling with a kid with a disability, there's so many factors and so much equipment. It's almost overwhelming enough to deter you from going. But this is right here. We know we can just go, and it's accessible. Julie Reiskin of the Colorado Cross Disability Coalition, who uses a wheelchair herself, said Aurora's decision to buy the chairs and make them available for free sets it apart among Colorado cities. She stressed the importance of free accommodations for people with disabilities, who tend to earn less than workers without disabilities. In 2019, the census reported that disabled workers on average made about two-thirds of what their able-bodied peers earned. I think a lot of disabled people don't know about these kinds of adaptive opportunities and might not even think about it if there isn't something offered, Reiskin said. An all-terrain wheelchair takes it to the next level, because what that says is you don't have to only stay on something that's really paved and perfect, and you can get out into more of the wilderness. Colorado Parks and Wildlife has deployed the chairs in at least three state parks, including Bar Lake near Brighton, which Green mentioned as an inspiration for Aurora's program. Green said Aurora considered buying the wheelchairs while developing a new master plan for the city's 100-plus parks and several thousand acres of open space. One of the priorities of the plan, which Aurora City Council indicated its support for March 25th, is ensuring all residents are able to access and enjoy city facilities. The city also recently unveiled a disability-friendly renovated playground at Fulton Park in East Aurora that features accessible swings, walkways, and parking. This is a theme throughout the master plan and everything we do, Green said. Our leadership is really trying to connect those dots and find those gaps and make things as accessible as possible. Chavez said she was grateful for the investment by the city and local schools and the success of disabled residents. Unless you have someone affected by a medical condition or a disability, there are things you don't think about, she said. But people in Aurora are thinking about it, and they're taking steps to make a difference. The city's two all-terrain wheelchairs are available to adults as well as children, and may be operated using a joystick or by a second person using a remote control. Information about reserving a chair is available at auroragov.org/track chairs. Judge reinstates Aurora pit bull ban, says 2021 City Council repeal was without authority. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Aurora residents are once again forbidden from owning pit bulls after a district court judge ruled this week that the Aurora City Council's decision in 2021 to repeal a ban on the dog breed defied the will of voters. In an email to the Sentinel, city spokesman Ryan Luby wrote that Aurora has not yet determined what enforcement of the ban might look like, what the ruling means for pit bull owners, and whether the city will appeal. Matt Snyder, the Aurora resident and member of the city's Civil Service Commission who independently filed the lawsuit against the city a few months after the ban was lifted, said the ruling gutted the argument that the former city council could unilaterally get rid of the legislation that had been upheld by a ballot question in 2014. "I like dogs, but it wasn't about dogs," Snyder said. "This could have been about car battery recycling, and I still would have done the same thing. The decision of the voters is, to me, holy ground. You just don't mess with that, because that is what keeps our democracy going." First introduced by the City Council in 2005, the pit bull ban survived a 2014 referendum asking voters whether it should be struck down, with roughly two-thirds of Aurorians expressing their desire to continue prohibiting the breed. Aurora City Charter states that a proposed ordinance adopted or rejected by electoral vote under either the initiative or referendum cannot be revived, repealed, amended, or passed except by electoral vote. In her ruling granting Snyder's motion for summary judgment against the city, 18th Judicial District Judge Elizabeth Beebe Voltz wrote that the language of the charter clearly prevented the council from striking down the ban after residents had voted to keep it. "The plain language of the city's charter and city code requires that, once an ordinance has been submitted to the voters by way or resolution or referendum, the subject ordinance cannot be revived, repealed, amended, or passed except by electoral vote," she wrote March 26th. Since the city did not submit the proposed repeal of the pit bull ban to another vote, its enactment of an ordinance contrary to the vote of the resolution proposing repeal was without authority and therefore is void. Voles previously found that Snyder wasn't allowed to sue the city because he failed to prove that he was personally harmed by the council's decision to repeal the ban. After Voles tossed the case, Snyder appealed, and early last year, the Colorado Court of Appeals found in Snyder's favor, returning the case to district court. When Snyder's case was allowed to proceed, attorneys representing the city of Aurora argued that the 2014 referendum was only advisory, since council members would still have had to sign off on the ordinance lifting the ban if the idea of going so had earned the support of voters. Snyder said attorneys representing the city had fought me every step of the way, contributing to the nearly three-year duration of the case. He also said he does not blame the current council for the choices made in 2021 and was hopeful that the group will accept the ruling of the court. Mayor Mike Kaufman wrote in an email to the Sentinel that he was unsure how the council would respond to the reinstatement of the ban, but mentioned how he opposed the 2021 repeal and proposed sending the question back to voters at the time, an idea that a majority of that council rejected. "My proposal copied what the Denver City Council had sent to the voters that I thought was a more balanced approach than the language used in Aurora's previous referendum," Kaufman said. "I've not had any discussions yet with council members since the decision came down." Councilmember Allison Combs, too, wrote in an email that she wasn't aware of any discussions among council members about how the city should respond. Republican committee to select Buck's likely replacement, adding a challenge to Boebert's campaign, by Jesse Bourdain, Associated Press. A panel of Colorado Republicans will select a candidate Thursday who will likely serve out the final months of U.S. Rep. Ken Buck's term, and could pose a challenge to Rep. Lauren Boebert's bid for another term in Congress. It's an unusual and confusing twist in a closely watched primary race for a district the far-right Republican Boebert has not represented previously. Whoever the committee chooses is expected to prevail in the special election against the Democratic nominee, finish Buck's term, and reinforce Republican slim majority in the U.S. House. But the decision could have farther-reaching consequences. The committee is expected to pick one of the current Republican primary candidates competing for the same seat. Boebert opted to finish her current term in her old district, and the committee will likely select one of her rivals. Whoever is picked would be running in two separate races for the same seat until the June election, giving them greater notoriety, media coverage, and expanded fundraising opportunities, a boon for most of the candidates who fall far short of Boebert's national name brand and campaign chest. "Ken Buck really threw a wrench into the whole thing," said Seth Maskett, director of the Center on American Politics in Denver, who noted that it's unclear what Buck's intentions are. "It was already a fairly topsy-turvy race, but I think this does make it a little bit harder for her." Boebert said in a recent statement that the move was interference. The establishment concocted a swampy backroom deal to try to rig an election. The congresswoman has built a far-right name with a ferocious political style, in step with the accusation of election rigging, and remains a known, if divisive, quantity among conservatives nationwide. While Boebert has made headlines with scandals, including a tape of her groping and vaping with a date and caught in a Denver theater, she's also garnered endorsements from former President Donald Trump and current Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. Those votes of confidence will likely go far for Boebert in the new district, where voters overwhelmingly supported Trump in 2020, and where her opponents are lesser known, local Republicans. While it would be hard for the other candidates to match Boebert's national conservative clout, the special election shakeup could give one of them an opportunity to make up some ground. "Whoever it is, they are going to be much more well-known come June," said Connor Dowling, a professor of political science at the University of Buffalo. Boebert nearly lost her old Republican-leaning district to a Democratic candidate in 2022. The slim margin raised questions of whether her Trumpian style still had purchase among GOP voters, after the Democrat who nearly beat her went on to far outraise her for an expected 2024 rematch, the congresswoman switched districts. The move incited grumblings about political maneuvering, with some of Boebert's homegrown primary opponents accusing her of carpetbagging. She defended the move by saying her voice is still needed in Congress, and that her exodus from the old district makes it easier for Republicans to retain the seat, and therefore their majority in the U.S. House. The option to district hop was open to Boebert after Buck announced he wouldn't run for re-election last year, citing his party's handling of Trump. Then, earlier this month, Buck abruptly resigned, pointing to the bickering and nonsense he said now pervades the U.S. Capitol. Buck left Congress on March 22nd. Leaders envision future of Arapaho Community College. Armed with sticky notes and markers, a group of people gathered in a large room at Arapaho Community College. Over the course of the evening, the attendees were asked to share what they think the college is doing well and what it could do better. It was the third stop of a statewide listening tour led by the Colorado Community College System, which is seeking input as it develops a new strategic plan. During the conversation at ACC, attendees shared a desire for more collaboration among colleges and highlighted the flexible scheduling and personal support that ACC offers its students. Attendees discussed current financial models and ways to strengthen cross-college collaboration through virtual programs. CCCS Executive Vice Chancellor Diane Duffy said the systems board created the tour to get in touch with those who will be most affected by future plans. How can we be responsive and develop strategies and goals and measures if we don't listen to what learners are saying, what employers are saying, she said. So this is like a gold mine to us. CCS oversees the state's 13 community college, including ACC. It is governed by a state-appointed board and serves an estimated 115,000 students annually through its colleges and programs, according to its website. The city's 10-year strategic plan comes to an end in 2025, and the system is looking at its next era. ACC is a magnet for students from Littleton and beyond. Almost half of its student body in fall 2022 resided in Douglas County. The most recent data available from the college's institutional research report. And over 26% of its students that semester lived in neighboring Arapahoe County. Another 12% were from Jefferson County, and other students even attended the school from as far away as Denver, Elbert, Adams, El Paso, Weld, Boulder, and Park counties. CCCS team, along with facilitators hired for the event, met with students and employees during the day on March 18th. In the evening, they broke out the sticky notes and pens for ACC's community partners. Attendees included industry partners that run apprenticeship programs, as well as representatives from local nonprofits, schools, and workforce programs. Several ACC and CCCS board members and staff and a Littleton resident also attended. Several industry partners said they were happy with ACC's willingness to create programs and collaborations based on what industry partners want. Jamie Pearson from Common Spirit Health Mountain Region said ACC staff was instrumental in developing the company's medical assistant apprenticeship program, which helped fill the healthcare group's need for people in that role. They took the lead at that time based on what we were needing as employers, she said. Todd Lambert, superintendent at Littleton Public Schools, said he hears many stories from parents who say the college helped their children navigate obstacles, challenges, and unique circumstances. There's a thread there for us that we hear coming back through, which is, man, are they appreciative that someone took an interest in their kids, he said. Several attendees also spoke highly of the college's flexible scheduling, which makes it possible for students to take classes on top of full-time jobs and or parenting responsibilities. The college also got praise for helping students in need. This school cares about its students enough to have scholarships and get grants to provide scholarships, Patrick Hallwell from Arapahoe Douglas Works Workforce Center said. If the kids are hungry, they have a food bank. This is huge because life gets in the way sometimes of your education. When discussing how the CCCS could improve its operations and service, creating more system-wide programming was a common theme. Every community college in the state has different resources and offers different programs, several industry partners said. In some cases, this makes it challenging for them to partner with the right programs because they may be physically far away. Stephen Shepard from the Denver Metro Building Owners and Managers Association suggested using virtual tools to share curriculum between and across the colleges. I think there's this economy of scale that can happen if the curriculum at the 13 community colleges is the curriculum of community college, and no matter which one is your home base, you can plug into some of these to make it a more robust experience, he said. Holwell said this type of collaboration across the colleges would especially benefit students in rural communities who often have to leave their areas to find specific educational program. Julie Beggs, the Vice President of Economic Mobility and Workforce Innovation at ACC, said this type of cross-college collaboration would require adjustments in financial models to incentivize it. CCS board member Karen McNeil Miller agreed. The financial model and budgeting and planning model would have to completely change, she said. For example, if several students from Pueblo Community College took a class virtually at ACC, Pueblo would get the revenue from the students' tuition, but ACC would carry the cost of the instructor. Regarding economic mobility, Sasha Easton from Arapaho Douglas Works Workforce Center said it's important to ensure those who are on public assistance at ACC are aware of the cliff effect, which is the sudden decrease in public benefits that can occur when an increase in earnings as defined by the National Conference of State Legislatures. There's a lot of tools available, but just so we're not setting the students up for failure as they embark on a new career pathway, she said. Jill Hawley, Vice President of Philanthropy at a philanthropy organization called Gary Community Ventures, said the strategic plan should mention innovation. The draft guiding principles for the CCCS strategic plan focus on economic mobility, education for all, the colleges being a partner of choice, the power of 13, colleges and empowered talent. When you read those five principles, it misses this idea of innovation, of cutting edge, of being on the forefront, she said. It feels in the way you read it as kind of the same and sort of responsive, as opposed to pushing, leading, cutting edge forward. ACC President Stephanie Fuji said, "The listening session is valuable not only for the overall system, but for the college. We appreciate your involvement, your engagement, your expertise, and your willingness to come and share," she said. The CCCS listening tour will continue through the end of April, visiting each community college in the system. EchoStar to sell Littleton Dish Network office. EchoStar Corp., which merged with Dish Network earlier this year, is planning to sell its Littleton property and then lease it back. The property, located just west of downtown Littleton at 5701 South Santa Fe Drive, is set to be sold for $26.75 million to Connex Corp., according to a March 11 filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Connex Corp. is a special-purpose acquisition company founded by EchoStar and Dish founder Charlie Ergen. EchoStar Corp. plans to lease the property back for an initial term of 10 years, with a base rent of $228,500 per month during the first year, with that rate to increase 2% annually, according to the filing. There will be 2 5-year renewal options. The parties anticipate the transaction will close in the second quarter of this year. EchoStar's 2023 year-end financial results showed an approximately 8.6% decrease in total revenue compared to 2022. And Dish Network, a wholly owned subsidiary of EchoStar Corp., has laid off more than 700 Colorado employees since November. Housing Bill Divides Littleton Leaders, by Nina Joss. Littleton City Council members discussed the concept of preemption, the value of punishment, and the need for affordable housing as they evaluated three state bills last week. The most contentious discussion at the March 19th meeting centered around House Bill 24-1313, which focuses on building housing near areas of transit. A resolution to oppose the bill, unless it was amended to remove the threat to local control and the threat to certain funds, narrowly failed. The vote was 3-4, with Mayor Kyle Schlotchler, District 1 Councilmember Patrick Driscoll, and District 4 Councilmember Andrea Peters voting to oppose the bill as written. The result of the vote means the city took no official stance on the bill. The bill mandates the rezoning of certain areas around rail and bus transit corridors by some local governments to allow more housing development in those areas. Although many city council members supported the idea behind the bill, some were opposed to the punishment, or stick, as they called it, that the bill includes. There are components of this that really align with the vision and direction of council, City Manager Kathleen Osher said. Our concern, of course, is that the forced rezoning of so many parcels in the city is just a very difficult position to be in, and particularly with this, they are putting in jeopardy the very vital dollars that we require from the Highway Users Tax Fund. If a community fails to meet the requirements of the bill, the state will hold and redistribute its Highway Users Tax Fund allocation. These dollars, collected from motor fuel taxes and fees, vehicle registration fees, and more, help counties and municipalities fund transportation projects. Those dollars are so significant to us in terms of addressing the maintenance and transportation needs, and, to some extent, the backlog that we have in terms of creating infrastructure, Osher said. The bill also stipulates that the State Department of Local Affairs has the authority to seek an injunction against jurisdictions that do not meet the expectations of the bill. Some council members said they were concerned about preemption or the idea that the bill would limit the power of local governments to make their own decisions about transit-oriented development. I think we all do share a burden on this and have to do it, but to say we have to build the exact same way Denver does, and the exact same way that Glendale does, and the exact same way that Broomfield does, is difficult because we have differences, Mayor Kyle Schlotchler said. District 2 Councilmember Robert Reichardt said he was frustrated with the preemption argument for opposing the bill. I just wish we were proposing a more forward-thinking solution to the problem, more than just, don't tell us what to do, he said. I don't feel like we're being solution-oriented. Littleton resident Spencer Hanks said he thinks the bill is strong, despite some of its imperfections. If Littleton decided to oppose the bill to maintain local autonomy, he said, the city should implement similar practices on its own. The last half century has really demonstrated that, while we hold in high regard our home rule and our autonomy, that kind of means that things don't really get done, he said. Even if we do not support some of the future and state-led efforts to come, we should look seriously at what this means for Littleton and implement them in our own unique way. Mayor Pro Tem Stephen Barr said he understands the concerns with the bill, but he thinks they need to be compared to the need for housing. These concerns have to be weighed against the severity of the housing crisis that we're currently facing, he said. What is the give and take? Although maintaining local control has been held sacrosanct by the Colorado Municipal League, which represents many local governments across the state, Barr said, that kind of relation to our local planning and zoning has not necessarily borne the fruits of the housing that our residents and our citizens actually need. The Colorado Municipal League voted to oppose the bill unless amended to remove punitive language that allows the state to withhold vital HUTF funding from local communities and removes local elected officials' ability to make decisions for their communities, according to its website. Barr also said he thinks the demands of the bill are narrow and do not exceed anything that the city council wouldn't do on its own. He added that the bill includes incentives, not just punishments, as it offers a grant program to support local governments in meeting these goals. Osher said another concern with the bill is that the transit system in Littleton isn't as vibrant as it was in recent years. City Attorney Reed Betzing said planning around RTD, a transportation system that has challenges, is a challenge of the legislation. The council passed resolutions in support of two other bills, Senate Bill 24-106 regarding a right to remedy construction defects, and Senate Bill 24-174 regarding sustainable affordable housing assistance. Colorado schools are poised to receive $11.4 million to combat the youth vaping crisis. The funding comes from a settlement between the State Attorney General's Office and e-cigarette manufacturer Juul Labs, Inc. Colorado has a youth mental health crisis that has fueled a vaping epidemic, said Attorney General Phil Weiser in a press release. These funds will support solutions and preventative measures that will help our children to make informed and better decisions about their health and well-being. The deal ends a lawsuit Weiser's office filed against Juul in 2020 for targeting young people in its marketing and misleading them about the health dangers of using its products. Juul settled with Colorado, along with several other states that joined the effort in 2023, for $462 million. Colorado's share was $31.7 million. The Colorado Department of Law and the Colorado Department of Education will disperse $3.8 million annually to local K-12 education providers beginning next year and ending in 2027. Weiser said his office is excited about the partnership and for the opportunity to ensure all Colorado schools can access and invest these funds. The new Vaping Education Prevention Grant provides much-needed resources for our school districts and boards of cooperative educational services to support students in learning about making healthy and responsible choices, said Colorado Education Commissioner Susanna Cordova. According to a press release from the Colorado Attorney General's office, schools receiving the grant must incorporate all or some of the following criteria: address the youth vaping crisis through education, prevention, and treatment; provide professional development opportunities for school staff; increase family and community involvement in promoting healthy lifestyles and choices for students; include activities and programming that incorporate youth voices and are culturally responsive; adopt or enhance comprehensive vaping and drug prevention policies that include ENDS and move towards student-centered alternatives to suspension approaches. Colorado teen vaping rates. According to the 2021 Health Kids Colorado survey, the latest year data is available. 16% of Colorado youth report using a vape daily. This percentage significantly decreased from 2019, when 26% of Colorado youth reported daily vaping. The portion of youth who said they'd ever vaped decreased from 46% in 2019 to 30% in 2021. Despite some positive downward trends in youth vaping, the percentage of youth who tried vaping before the age of 13 rose from 13% in 2019 to 22% in 2021, and the percentage of students who use vape products because they are flavored increased to 23%. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment conducts the Healthy Kids Colorado Survey in the fall of odd-numbered years. The 2023 Healthy Kids Colorado Survey results will be available this summer. Youth vaping is a concerning issue, said Chelsea Andrews, CDPHE's tobacco communication specialist. CDPHE is actively supporting communities in their efforts to limit children's and youth's exposure to tobacco advertising and access to tobacco through its State Tobacco Education and Prevention Partnership Grant Program. Andrews said the department encourages parents and trusted adults to discuss vaping with young people. More information about how to start these conversations is available at https://www.tobaccofreeco.org/. In addition, Andrews said that young people between ages 12 and 17 can access free, confidential support to quit smoking or vaping by texting Start My Quit to 36072 or visiting www.mylifemyquit.org for more information. Support available in Centennial and Parker for families facing Alzheimer's memory loss. An Alzheimer's or memory loss diagnosis can be daunting for a family. The Alzheimer's Association of Colorado provides programs, resources, and services for those living with the disease, their caregivers, and communities. We really recommend people live in the moment, said Kelly Ostoff, Senior Director of Programs. The association is holding 3 11-week workshops and support groups in Centennial, Parker, and Longmont for people living with Alzheimer's disease and their care partners starting the first week of April. A few spots are left. This workshop is designed to get people connected to a community of others going through the same experience, said Ostoff. Providing a safe and supportive environment, the groups offer education, emotional support, and resources from a variety of trained facilitators to help members enhance their lives. In Centennial, the workshop will be held Wednesday from 10 a.m. to noon starting April 3rd at Smoky Hill United Methodist Church, 19491 East Smoky Hill Road. The Parker workshop will be held Thursdays from 10 a.m. to noon starting April 4th at Joy Lutheran Church, 7051 Parker Hills Court. Then starting later, on August 8th, the Longmont workshop will be held on Thursdays from 9:30 a.m., 910 Longs Peak Avenue. Not everyone living with dementia is able or comfortable talking about their symptoms and their changes, said Ostoff, so they might not want to go to the workshops. For those interested in the workshop, registration is required by Tuesday, April 2nd, as there is a screening process to ensure people are comfortable talking. Call the Alzheimer's Association free 24/7 helpline at 800-272-3900 for details. The workshops are really just such a small part of what we do, said Ostoff. It's designed for a rather small audience. The association also has programs, education, and support groups year-round to help those living with early stages of a diagnosis and as it progresses. The diagnosis of early-stage Alzheimer's disease can affect everyone who cares for the individual, which is why the care partner's role is important. Not only do they provide support and friendship, but they also help walk through difficult decisions and plan for the future. The Alzheimer's Association of Colorado has over 70 support groups for caregivers that are both in person and virtual, as well as one-on-one caregiver support and care consultation. Additionally, there are cultural, artistic, and social programs for people living with memory loss, such as memory cafes and musical groups. Other programs include educational classes that can be taken online or in person, early stage programs, support groups, online tools, and more. Resources and programs can be found at https://www.alz.org/co/helpingyou. The association has support groups that meet regularly in Parker and also provide an array of services to the community and nearby communities. Osthoff said the best way to learn about what's happening near them is to call the helpline at 800-272-3900. It's available in English and Spanish. Littleton legend Sonia Ellingbo receives inaugural Arts and Culture Award by Nina Joss. The Littleton Museum was packed with more than 150 artists, business owners, and city leaders on the evening of March 27th. It was the city's third annual State of the Arts event, where leaders shared local and regional metrics on arts and cultural activity in the city. But this year, the attendance was over double the previous 2 years' turnout. That's what happens when you're honoring a local legend, Museum Director Tim Nims said. During the event, the Arts and Culture Board presents the city's first-ever Arts and Culture Award to Sonia Ellingbo, a longtime force in Littleton's civic and cultural life, and a regular writer and columnist for our newspapers. Until her retirement in late 2023, her arts and culture writing appeared in the Littleton Independent, Centennial Citizen, Inglewood Herald, and other South Metro newspapers. The honor is awarded to an individual, group, or organization that exemplifies innovative and creative ways to make meaningful connections within the Littleton community through arts and culture, said J.D. McCrum, the board's vice chair. The board received 5 nominations for the award. They were all very deserving, board chair Kate Eckel said, but Ellingbo blew them all out of the water. Sonia just had a breadth of what she had done, and for a number of years, and how much she's promoted arts and culture in the city, she said. It was just overwhelmingly clear. Ellingbo, 93, was born in Columbus, Ohio in 1930 and grew up in Pittsburgh, according to the event's program. She adopted Littleton as her hometown when she moved to the city in 1956 with her husband and the first of what would ultimately be 4 children. In the decades that followed, Ellingbo made an impact on almost every corner of the city's civic and cultural makeup. In the decades that followed, Ellingbo made an impact on almost every corner of the city's civic and cultural makeup. She joined or helped launch many of the city's important institutions, including the local League of Women Voters, the Town Hall Arts Center, the Bemis Library Fine Arts Committee, the Littleton Business Chamber, the Commission on Human Rights, the Littleton Fine Arts Guild, Hudson Gardens, Friends of the Library and Museum, the Littleton Garden Club, and Historic Littleton, Inc. She owned the Bookhouse Bookstore in downtown Littleton from 1970 to 1986 and worked briefly as a librarian, the program says. In her late 50s, Ellingbo entered the career of which many Littleton residents nowadays know her. For 35 years, she worked as a writer for newspapers, first for the short-lived Littleton Times, before joining the Littleton Independent, also contributing to the Independent sister newspapers as the company grew. Her writing mainly focused on art, music, stage performance, and culture. Readers loved her work. Waiting for her weekly reports on a play, art exhibit, or unique program, said Thelma Grimes, former editor of the Littleton Independent, who nominated Ellingbo for the award. When I had the privilege of sitting down with her and talking about her family, life, and career, I was even more enlightened about the impact she has on Littleton and the Denver metro area, Grimes said, referencing a profile she wrote when Ellingbo retired. This award serves as an exclamation point to an exemplary career. A lifelong passion for the arts. Event attendees gave Ellingbo a standing ovation as she received her award, which is a piece of artwork by local glass artist and sculptor Diana Whitlock. In her reception speech, Ellingbo reflected on her passion for the arts and libraries, which started with a childhood routine to visit the Carnegie Mellon Library and Museum with her father on Saturdays. She said her passion for arts and culture never went away after that. "I'd recommend it as a way of life for anybody," she said. "I think that's the main thing, is just get out and go do the art shows. It made Littleton a great place to raise kids, I think. Many of you have discovered that." After raising four kids in Littleton, Ellingbo now has grandchildren and a great-grandchild, with a second great-grandchild due any day now. She said she has enjoyed watching her family members get involved in the art scene as well. Her son, Bruce Ellingbo, said his mother's involvement in the arts has always been a part of his life. He said it was exciting to see her receive the award. "She's been doing arts things as long as I can remember," he said. In addition to being a champion of the art scene, Ellingbo is an artist herself. Her family said she was a painter who enjoyed using watercolors, and she also did ceramics work. "We're so proud of her," said Ellingbo's daughter, Kirsten Orahood. The state of the arts. During the event, museum leaders said there was a steady increase in arts attendance in the community over the past year. They said almost 3 million visitors interacted with local arts and culture industries in the community. They also highlighted the success of the new lodger's tax, a tax on stays at hotels and motels. Its revenue contributed almost $850,000 to the Littleton Arts and Culture Center in its first year. Nim said the tax revenue and the city leadership's support of arts and culture in Littleton is exciting. "The tax made it possible for the Arts and Culture Board to offer grants to arts and culture organizations for the first time. When we were first talking about the lodger's tax, we were kind of in survival mode," he said. "We were thinking, this is going to be for sustaining organizations. But as how we got into last year's first cycle, and as we're going into this year's cycle, what we're seeing is it's actually enabling organizations to take a next step." The leaders noted that the arts and culture industry is great for Littleton's overall economy. City Manager Jim Becklenburg said the city's recent economic development strategic plan pointed at arts and culture as a primary and attainable sector for growth in the future. "We're really poised to capitalize on all the energy that we have happening with our Arts and Culture Board and the organizations that are here," he said at the event. With arts and culture offering benefits for the economy and for the soul, Ellingbo left attendees with a call to action and gratitude. She encouraged them to take advantage of the shows and exhibits in their community and thank them for the award. "It's exciting," Ellingbo told the Littleton Independent regarding her award, "except I had a moment of nostalgia that I wish I had a deadline. I guess I was thinking I was really tired of deadlines, but I wish I still was going to this event to report on it." Press release. Dr. Michelle Haney to receive Bennett Lifetime Achievement Award by sponsored content. Lakewood, Colorado. Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society, PTK, is set to honor Dr. Michelle Haney alongside 8 distinguished retiring college presidents and chancellors, presenting them with the Michael Bennett Lifetime Achievement Award at the Society's annual convention in Orlando, Florida, April 4th through 6th, 2024. Nominated by the students on their respective campuses, these awards are bestowed upon retiring college presidents who have demonstrated unwavering support for student success initiatives, leading to stronger pathways to completion, transfer, and employment. These individuals have taken an active interest in supporting high-achieving students and cultivating student leaders within their campuses. These college leaders have made student success a priority throughout their career, says Phi Theta Kappa President and CEO Dr. Lynn T. Tincture Ladner. This award is special because it comes directly from the students, and it is evidence of the gratitude they feel for the support for them and students like them, both inside and outside the classroom. The award is named in honor of the late Dr. Michael Bennett, longtime president of St. Petersburg College in Florida. About Red Rocks Community College. Established in 1969, Red Rocks Community College delivers high-quality, affordable education programs leading to degrees or professional certificates. The college serves over 10,000 students per year online and at campus locations in Lakewood and Arvada. About Phi Theta Kappa. Phi Theta Kappa is the premier honor society recognizing the academic achievement of students at associate degree granting colleges and helping them to grow as scholars and leaders. The society is made up of more than 3.8 million members and nearly 1,300 chapters in 11 countries, with approximately 240,000 active members in the nation's colleges. Learn more at ptk.org. Thank you for joining us for the Arapaho County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.